China's influence is rising, but how is it changing the countries around it? From Radio Free Europe, I'm Reed Standish, and this is Talking China in Eurasia, a podcast about how Beijing is changing the balance of power. Is China ready to step up its support for Moscow and send military aid to Russia? On today's episode, we'll be exploring this question, which could change the course of the war in Ukraine and have wide-ranging repercussions for Washington, Beijing, and the world. Helping me understand how we got to where we are now and where we might be headed is Andrew Small, senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, who is joining me from Berlin. So, Andrew, attention has been hyper-focused of late on this question of whether Xi Jinping is ready to shift China's engagement on the war in Ukraine and supply Russia with weapons. In the last few weeks, we've seen a steady drip of comments from the U.S. and from Europe that Xi is considering sending lethal aid to Russia. American officials, including CIA Director Bill Burns, have said publicly that this transfer has not yet taken place, but that it's currently being debated. Obviously, this could be a game changer if it were to take place. So as a longtime China hand like yourself, who has spent many hours in rooms with Chinese foreign policymakers over the years, I'm curious how you view this allegation. Do you think that Beijing is willing to cross this line?
So thanks, Reed. Let me just check that I'm coming through okay now.
Yeah, loud and clear. We can hear you. So I'm curious, Andrew, how do you see this?
So, I mean, to me, from the very beginning of the war, the question on this issue has been a when issue rather than a whether. What are the circumstances in which China might be willing to do this rather than is this something that they would be willing to rule out indefinitely? And I think that's still the set of circumstances that we have on this now. They know there will be a price to pay if they were to do this. The requests have come in from the Russian side already. This has been kind of coming in relatively consistently. We know the supplies that Russia has been turning to from other actors, from North Korea, from Iran. And so the question for China really is it willing across a much more extended period of time to continue to say no to Russia? What will be the cost if it does so, which I think it's still in a certain sense trying to determine. But there's also what is the cost if it fails to do so? Will this be materially costly for the relationship with Russia? Will it be materially costly for the Russian war effort? Or do they have another means of achieving the same objectives? And I think it does seem from the information that is coming through at the moment, even if it does appear so far to be coming largely from Russian sources, that this is a decision in the balance on the Chinese side. And I can see very well why it would be in the balance. They'll be trying to assess what the consequences would be for relations, not just with the United States, but with Europe, where the Russian war effort is placed, how important Chinese support would actually be, how easy it's going to be to do something like this deniably. I don't think they would want to do any of this excessively overtly. They do a lot of this through third channels, including through a couple of the countries that were mentioned. And ultimately, as this plays out, is this going to be something that becomes too damaging to sustain over an extended stretch? I mean, refusing to provide Russia with support during a period in which it's, you know, fighting from its perspective a kind of existential set of national goals, is that something where China's willingness to stand aside is something that they would be willing to sustain? So my inclination has always been that there will be a juncture in which they're willing to cross that threshold, okay. But they'll do it in as kind of gray zone away as they possibly can to test out some of the reactions first. And we've already seen that in a certain sense with the transfer of a lot of the dual use materials that have already taken place.
Right. Well, Andrew, I mean, before launching forward and unpacking a bit of what you just said, you know, I want to take a few steps back and use that opportunity to, you know, talk about what you get into in your book, which is called No Limits or The Rupture, depending if you're in North America or Europe. You know, in there, you catalog the origins of this China-Russia relationship that we're seeing play out today. And I mean, this dynamic has traveled quite far just in the last year with the declaration of a No Limits partnership between the two countries and Beijing defending its close ties with Moscow. I'm hoping you can, you know, give a bit of an explanation of how we got here, you know, and especially how we got to this level of partnership that we're seeing now. You know, just a few years ago, you know, this relationship was, you know, kind of seen by as a rivalry. There was technological theft. There was deep suspicion on each side. So, you know, in your book, I really like this episode that you have, which is, you know, you're talking about, hey, Andrew, would you be able to mute yourself? Because I think you're getting a bit of feedback there on your side. Thank you. So, I mean, in your book, you talk about Russia's 2008 invasion of Georgia, which took place on the same day as the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics that year. And you describe this really strong reaction from Hu Jintao, Chinese leader at the time, to Russia's actions. So I'm hoping you can, you know, tell us a bit about how China reacted back in 2008 when Russia invaded a country. And, you know, what was the relationship like back then at that point? What was it really looking like?
So you can go through these three junctures, 2008, 2014, and what we saw last year. And really, you can see the difference and the kind of evolution in the Chinese response in all of these cases. In 2008, it is, of course, extremely embarrassing that the timing of the launch of the invasion of Georgia, not only does China kind of make its pretty critical position on this as clear as it can, with, you know, all the appropriate diplomatic dancing around that they still do on this, but they help to kind of mobilize some of the critical reaction as well in Central Asia from various of their partners there. You then fast forward to 2014, and you have what looks like a genuinely neutral stance that's taken. In fact, as I mentioned in the book, your various European officials who go to China in the run-up to the current war, in the run-up to the invasion, and basically ask them to take a similar stance to the one they took in 2014. Just be as neutral as you can. Do something that really looks like neutrality, and of course being rebuffed by the Chinese. And so you have to look at then what has gone on in this period of time. And Crimea is really the biggest kind of threshold crossing moment, I think, in terms of the kind of material situation that Russia finds itself in. It's only after 2014 that you get the willingness on the Russian side to make moves in all of these areas that they had not been willing to in the preceding years. The energy deal with China, the willingness to transfer advanced weaponry, even the willingness to allow certain forms of Chinese investment in Russia. And of course, that reflects the situation that Russia then finds itself in, under sanctions from the West, and in a kind of far closer to a prior position than it was before, and in need of certain forms of economic support that it wasn't before. So there was kind of a forced situation of having to reevaluate whether all of these old concerns that were there about China really made sense anymore. You know, everything around divisions over Central Asia, views about China's role in the Russian Far East, all of these things. And so you had a real push to try and get past a lot of these issues on the Russian side. But even before 2014, you have this very different kind of affinity, particularly on Xi Jinping's part, but really at the top levels of the party in different ways with Russia. Of course, you have this sort of seeming personal tie between Xi Jinping and Putin. But I remember when I was living in Beijing in the mid-2000s, you have this striking level of affinity between people at the top of the Chinese Communist Party and Putin personally.
Can I jump in there, Andrew? Because, I mean, that was something that, you know, it really strikes out to me that, you know, when Xi comes into power in 2013, there is a very noticeable shift there. And I like that there's something that really stood out to me in your book. You know, you kind of talk about this, you know, fascination or awe almost that some Chinese officials seem to have for Putin and, you know, his willingness to push the envelope and you know, kind of thumb the eye of the West, you know, whether it's with Crimea or we're talking Syria in 2015. And then, you know, you talk about that personal affinity. You know, I believe in there you also have that she, you know, talks about Putin and says that he's a real man. And then back, you know, in famously in 2013, she says to him, you know, we are similar in character. So, I mean, how much of that personal relationship is really what is driving this, you know, this wider strategy? Is it just really between the two men at the top?
So, I mean, it was always striking when working on this issue back, like in the early to mid 2000s, how much it was the case, even then, that at the very top, you had some of these affinities. And it wasn't just about the real man bit, though I'll kind of say a word about that as well. It was just the kind of shared outlook on a lot of the kind of issues that they were dealing with. They would trade tips when Putin came through Beijing on domestic repression techniques, essentially. The Chinese saying things like, oh, you know, you're not doing a good enough job on your internet controls. Putin saying you're not doing a good enough job on controlling some of the foreign NGOs, that this sort of thing. They found a level of affinity there in terms of, it's not just common authoritarianism. They come from a kind of shared longer legacy of the communist background that both of them were dealing with. And I think it is one of the other areas of analysis from some of the people like Gil Rosman, who were writing about this back in 2014. There is just much more of a shared legacy between the two states. And certainly that's something that Xi Jinping seems personally to have been strongly identified, not just with Russia, but with has had a real level of respect for Soviet Russia. I mean, that's been the kind of the shaping influence for him. When he talks about the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's also, you know, as with Putin, framed as this kind of geopolitical catastrophe. Of course, this is kind of, again, common at the top levels of the Chinese Communist Party, but something that Xi Jinping himself, I think, is even more ideologically attached to than some other leaders have been on this. But they also do find Putin to be this leader who's willing to take bold choices that they were sometimes afraid to take themselves. The PLA was always very impressed with the actions that were taken in Crimea and to a certain extent in Syria. There was a kind of strategic boldness. And sometimes some of the Chinese leaders would see themselves as, you know, maybe excessively cautious. They know in a certain way that Russia does not, that they have time on their side. They can make their advances much more incrementally. But they sometimes wondered whether they were holding back too much on some of these things. So, but I mean, beyond all of this, from the perspective of a leader in Xi Jinping who sees the struggle with the United States, and not just the United States, with the kind of liberal order, the West more generally, as a kind of the essential situation that Chinese foreign policy and China's strategic position is in, Russia is the power that can really augment China's position across the board in all sorts of different ways, militarily, with its complementary economy, and this kind of common worldview as it translates diplomatically in the shared intelligence networks, in propaganda. There's no other partner that China has that offers the same sort of magnitude of improving that capacity to deal with this shared threat that Russia does. And so that's really been the other thing that's underpinned all of this, going back to a lot of the debates that you were starting to have in the Chinese system even after the financial crisis.
Right. Interesting. Well, I want to get, you know, to this No Limits Partnership announcement, which comes in early February 2022, before Russia invaded Ukraine. Putin goes to Beijing for the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics there. They make this sweeping declaration about China and Russia working closer together than ever before, and really trying to shape a world order. And I think that that's also a pretty clear sign of, you know, shaking off some of those inhibitions on Chinese foreign policy that you were alluding to before. But when you know, we're a bit over a year out from that moment. You know, when you look back on it, I mean, are you surprised on how that has shaped things in the last year, especially throughout the war?
So, I mean, again, going into the war, whatever China knew or believed was going to happen beforehand, and, you know, I would certainly land with those who would expect that, you know, they were not given any more details than various actors on the Russian side were given as to what was actually going to go on there. So they would have been surprised, whatever they were told, because their analysis was that if Russia conducted an operation like this, it would be something that was fast and successful. Again, not an analysis that many others disagreed with as well from all sorts of other contexts. So the kind of willingness to be as bold as I think Xi Jinping was with that joint statement in the context that he made it, I think was informed by a backdrop assumption that was, if Russia does anything, they will be able to pull it off in the way that they were able to before, and they'll be able to pull it off and reset relations with the West, as to a certain extent they were able to with Crimea. The sanctions were not so biting. diplomatic ties were restored. They were only partially a pariah. A limited number of actors were really pariah actors on the Russian side, and economic linkages picked up again. And I think this was what the Chinese had expected they would be dealing with. So I think they were caught off guard, not only by how the war played out, but by the strength of the international response, and particularly the Western response, but also, you know, a number of countries in Asia, Japan, Singapore, and others who did not take the same kind of stance back in 2014. This looked like a very different coalition to the one that China was and Russia was looking at back then. But what you've seen, in a sense, over the period since then, and I mean, the important thing about that joint statement, if you would say what was the threshold crossing element of it, it wasn't just the extremely sensitive timing, doing it in the run up to the invasion in the way that in the manner that it was, but also the fact that the two sides essentially agreed to provide certain forms of reciprocal support in their respective theaters in a way that they had not been willing to that extent before. In China's case, what it meant was providing what was described as sympathy and support for the two Russian treaty proposals that they laid out in the preceding December, essentially demanding a rollback of NATO. And this was something, I mean, a vision of the security order in Europe, where China had not been willing to provide support to the Russian position on that, because they knew it would be so costly for relations with the rest of Europe if they were to do so. But in this instance, they were willing to take that collateral damage. And I think what we've seen over the last year is a different willingness to take collateral damage in Europe, and to a certain extent with the United States as well, as a result of a very different form of backing that China has provided to Russia in a way that it did not after 2014. We know there are other things they won't do. They will not take risks with their companies that might find themselves kind of sanctioned out of existence by the United States as a result of providing certain transfers, particularly the Chinese tech firms and things like that. But we've seen forms of diplomatic and propaganda support that China didn't provide before. And what we've also seen, certainly now that we've got the data on the last year, is a pretty expansive form of economic and kind of targeted dual use support to Russia, in a form that I think is what Russia would have expected. If you were to step away, they had the experience of what China was and was not willing to do after 2014. They didn't go against sanctions after 2014 either. They didn't do a lot in the first few months after the annexation of Crimea, in fact, at all. It was longer-term forms of a kind of bolstering and backdrop of support that China was willing to provide. And that's largely what they've provided to Russia in this instance, except that, I mean, they have also been willing to do highly sensitive military exercises with Russia in the middle of all of this as well. They've conducted very sensitive diplomatic visits in the middle of all of this. And I think they've just made very clear what their ultimate position is, even as they, in different ways, try to find slight ways to placate the Europeans in particular, where they still see value in being able to maintain relations at a certain level.
Well, I think that gets into, I mean, coming back again to this issue of, if is China willing to cross that line and send in, you know, a more direct form of military support? And I'm going to turn now to a question, an audience question. This one comes from Paul Knowles, who's a subscriber to the China and Eurasia newsletter. So Paul's question for you, Andrew, is he wants to know, you know, to what extent do you think that Xi's support for Putin is conditional on him not losing in Ukraine? And I mean, I guess that also then gets into, okay, we saw China throw its hat into the ring with this 12-point proposal for ending the war. But I guess also maybe more on the point is, you know, a lot of people are speculating the logic for Beijing considering sending weapons deliveries to Russia, right? It's that China doesn't want Moscow to be totally defeated and weakened in Ukraine. I mean, and there's enough kind of unbalance of their relationship in China's favor already. But so, I mean, does China still want a partner that is a considerably weakened Russia, and is preventing that outcome, you know, strong enough that they're going to send weapons to head it off?
So, I mean, this what does defeat look like from China's perspective? Certainly, they would like to maintain Putin in power. There is a kind of, you know, any Russian China Hand will make clear. There is a kind of Putin premium to all of this. I think, you know, again, things have moved a lot over the last 8 years, but nonetheless, I think there is a certain willingness to cost Russia's lot in with China on Putin's part. It hasn't always been as fully shared in other parts of the system on the Russian side. China's quite well aware of this. So there is a kind of additional value to Putin's role for China in this regard. So they don't want to see him suffer a kind of political defeat as a result of this. And they certainly, in the wider kind of context, don't want to see Russia actually lose the war. But I mean, what that actually amounts to, one can then debate. I think the issue for China on this, though, I mean, that coming up with answers to that is then part of the problem from their perspective. What is the situation that Russia finds itself in? What are its needs when it comes to resupply? And does China have to be the one that actually does it? Because again, I mean, to go back to the earlier point, they can find ways to do this that are much more deniable and careful than you know, a kind of big, again, threshold crossing moment in which they provide significant forms of supplies directly.
I think what do those kind of other alternatives look like? Exactly. I know earlier you alluded to, okay, is it through Iran? Is it through North Korea? Is it Belarus? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, North Korea and Iran are two of the obvious kind of conduits for this, where, you know, we're certainly aware. I mean, there's then also, what is it that Russia wants? I think a lot of the focus at the moment has been on artillery. I mean, there were all the stories about drones. Russia's already getting commercial drones from China. There were these stories being out in a sort of slightly debated story in Spiegel about kamikaze drones that Russia was purchasing. And we know over the long term that drones are one of the things that Russia has wanted and has been interested in these technologies from China even before the war. But I think the question that has been the focus really in the last period of time has been artillery, ammunition, resupplies. And so that's something where we've already seen Russia going to North Korea for this. We've seen Iran supplying drones already. I think one of the questions there has been whether, I mean, a lot of the transfers that China conducts in this are done with cutouts and other suppliers and things. They're not necessarily done as directly. I think you're already starting to get some concerns in intelligence services about the sort of how some of these networks are being reactivated or kind of stimulated in the context that we find ourselves in. Again, there's kind of talk of a China Russia, Iran axis when it comes to some of these things. So I think it's not necessarily, I mean, this is why I think, you know, China will want to stay in the gray zone on a lot of this. And so if they can find another way to do it that achieves the same effect, I think they'll still be relatively careful about the manner in which they go about doing it.
Okay, well, I'm going to turn to another audience question now here, Andrew. And this is also for everyone listening live right now. If you have a question you'd like to ask live to Andrew or myself, you can raise your hand. And if we have time, we will come to you. So this question comes from Stephen Jones. So he has a question about how do you think, what's your assessment of Beijing's view of Russia's obvious failures in Ukraine from a military perspective?
So, I mean, there's different layers on this, because there's what is China learning with respect to the kind of specific concerns that it has with, in particular, Taiwan. I mean, there's questions about Russian kit and things like that. We we know this will take a while for the PLA to internalize, and we don't have kind of absolutely clear guide on what they've already taken from this so far. But you're certainly, I think, the early assessments on this would be that they'll be concerned about the kind of strategic impact of, you know, precision guided missiles on the way the war has played out, how much they're able to do with that alone. There'll be, I think there's a lot of assessment on whether the unwillingness of Russia to commit hard and fast enough. The beginning of the war is something that was advisable, and what lessons that means for Taiwan. There's certainly lessons to learn about the failures to control the information environment. And of course, we're seeing all this playing out with everything from, you know, questions around undersea cables to what's going on with Starlink and all of the issues around there. And simply the kind of the successful information strategy on Ukraine's part to mobilize international support for the war. So there's a few of these sorts of things. I mean, of course, we know that the scenarios that China's looking at, in particular with reference to Taiwan, look very different from some of the specific issues that Russia's been facing. And it's not just the kind of classic military questions. I think there's been a question of societal preparedness that China will have been looking at as well. How important is it to prepare your society for a war that may play out over a longer time, and the kind of hardships in certain ways that the society may find itself going through. And I think they will certainly think that was not something that was prepared for on the Russian side, and something that they might expect to have to do more of themselves. But I think we're still in the early stages of kind of seeing what lessons are the Chinese are taking on this. I think the big concern, of course, is the nuclear signaling issue. We have seen some discussion from kind of Chinese military analysts about the question of whether Russia's willingness to threaten nuclear weapons use has deterred certain forms of US or NATO involvement. And I think there's been quite a concern from the US side and from the Western side to signal that this has not been the material element that has in any sense deterred certain other forms of involvement from the US. And therefore, this is also not something that China should be thinking about replicating in Taiwan scenarios as well. But it's certainly something that has been openly speculated about by certain analysts on the Chinese side.
Okay, well, it's quite interesting. I mean, all right, so I think that goes in well into another question that we're having here from the audience here on Twitter. So this is a written one here. Just basically, I mean, okay, this is tough to game out. We don't know exactly, but they ask, what is the impact if China does decide to supply weapons to Russia? Does NATO interject? Does the West sanction China? I mean, obviously, a sanctions response, you know, my quick reading on that is that's going to be quite tough to do given how intertwined the economies are. But also, you know, we've seen Brussels, we've seen Washington, you know, draw a line quite clearly in the sand that, you know, this is something that's going to have repercussions if it happens. So I'm curious, how do you see something like this playing out if it does? And maybe, Andrew, you know, what in the different scenarios? I mean, you're saying that the more kind of obvious, you know, direct transfer, you say, is probably far less likely, but especially if it's in this gray zone thing, I mean, that can still be traced back to China in some way. So I'm curious, you know, as we start to game this out, what does that kind of look like in your mind?
So, I mean, I gave some of the answers that were the why China may want to do this. But as we were discussing at the beginning, this is not a done deal for precisely these reasons. One of them is because there is an indeterminacy about what the response would be. I think if China thought they could do this and there would be very few repercussions, I see very little reason why they wouldn't. The question is exactly what do those repercussions look like? And this is why I think the fact that you ended up with sanctions on a scale that exceeded Chinese expectations against Russia gives them some additional pause. There is some unpredictability to what the response might actually look like from the Western side on this. And I mean, US officials have stressed to China very carefully throughout that they are watching everything very closely in a way that, you know, to some extent they were not in the same way after 2014. They certainly weren't issuing these warnings, and that they would take action if China were to replicate this. And I think what you're seeing in terms of the intelligence leaks and things like this are indicative of the fact that every time China starts tiptoeing closer to one of these thresholds, or there's any evidence of that, this starts being pushed and shared more actively to a certain extent in public and certainly among allies on this. And we've already had a lot of exchanges transatlantically, at least, on whether to on the question of sanctioning China. I mean, I think this is kind of bubbling around in the background very actively at the moment. And it's, of course, a very difficult one to prepare for the reasons that you suggest, Reid. I mean, this is, of course, the Europeans do sanction China in various other contexts, Xinjiang, arms transfers, a whole series of other areas. But this would really be a different kind of step to take. And I don't think it's just about the sanctions, because I think in the end, as we've seen in the last year, the willingness to put certain kinds of sanctions on these issues is there. And however difficult it is to agree any of these things, they have ended up being agreed in ways that go quite a long way beyond what anyone had anticipated. The question is rather what's the wider cost for China to the relationship, particularly with Europe. And I think this is why it's been so important from a US perspective that you've had European leaders out there warning publicly at the highest levels that there will be repercussions if this happens. China's in a situation at the moment where, of course, relations with the United States have declined to a place where, yes, they still have further to fall. That's absolutely true. But relations with Europe have much, much further to fall. And to a certain extent, China wants to maintain a certain level of, they certainly don't want to have a strengthened transatlantic coalition directed at them, but they also want to maintain a degree of openness on Europe's part, economically and particularly for access to technologies, that they're seeing closing ever more tightly on the US side. And it has been closing in Europe, but not as quickly and not as comprehensively as it has in the US. So there is a right. risk for them in this, not just in terms of which sanctions are put in place directly on the entities that are involved or the individuals that are involved, but rather the wider cost to the relationship that really hits them on precisely the areas of kind of national self-reliance that Xi Jinping's been going on about in recent days.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a lot. I was just going to say, you know, at the two sessions that's just been happening this week. I mean, that was a big focus of Xi's speech. You know, I think he kind of in an unprecedented fashion really took aim at the United States. And we've seen that from other Chinese officials on the sidelines of the two sessions as well. You know, some quite heated rhetoric. I mean, a lot of it is geared towards the United States. But, you know, I think that also then do you want to create this, as you say, this kind of create that alliance even further on the West that's directed on you. And, you know, it is kind of a strategy of containment that the U.S. is waging right now. And do you want Europe to also be following suit? And I suppose sending arms is a good way to make sure that that does happen. Especially, I guess, and then we have Macron is supposed to be headed to Beijing sometime in the next month or so. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's due in early April. I'm not sure the exact dates.
Right. So, I mean, I imagine that would kind of change the tenor of that visit from, you know, Macron, maybe he's there to attend Belt and Road Forum and, you know, speak about, you know, how cooperation between Beijing and Europe and Paris can still continue forward into something where Macron has to, you know, kind of speak for the transatlantic alliance. So, Andrew, I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. As another reminder to anyone listening, if you have another question, please raise your hand or tweet at us and bring it up. But Andrew, I have a question. This is something that, as we've been talking about two sessions, this is something that's on my mind, and I see it, and I have my own thoughts about how to interpret it, but I'm curious to get your take, you know, which is, you know, how does Beijing see the war in Ukraine links to the situation in Taiwan? You know, in public comments, we've seen a lot of Chinese officials saying that Ukraine and Taiwan, they're very different issues. They shouldn't be linked together or framed together, yet they clearly share some pretty glaring similarities. So what, in your mind, I mean, what is Beijing trying to do when it says things like that? And how do you think the war in Ukraine has really changed China's view about any type of scenario to unify with Taiwan?
So, I mean, there's two or three distinct things in this. One is how China thinks they should talk in public about the linkages. And they've gone through certain cycles of saying these two are completely distinct. This one is a kind of national sovereignty quest. The national sovereignty question that is at stake, and we saw this from Wang Yi in Munich, the national sovereignty issue that's at stake is coming from Taiwanese independence the Taiwanese independence movement. If you care about national sovereignty in the way that you say you do about Ukraine, you should also care about those who wish to violate it, who are Taiwanese independence types. And so there's been a kind of, if insofar as Ukraine and Taiwan have a very distinct international status, China has been quite careful to stress publicly among its diplomats these distinctions. And you saw a little bit with Qingang just in the last few days as well. Because, I mean, they're normally careful to avoid drawing the analogies publicly on this. But insofar as they do, that's kind of become the line on this. Of course, privately, there's then a whole different kind of mode of analysis on these questions. And I would still lean with those who say that it will introduce an additional note of caution on the Chinese side. I think going back to this question of the strategic boldness of Putin and the kind of the points at which the PLA has been impressed by Russian successes, of course the context for their being impressed and wondering whether they should be so bold themselves was Taiwan. And the question in that instance was, one, how easy is it to kind of conduct an operation like this? And I mean, there's a completely different set of analyses militarily on this versus is the question of, if you do this, can you get away with it? And part of the what was seen to be successful about Crimea was that it was achieved quickly, consolidated, and they essentially kind of got away with it. And I think the sense has been, by contrast, what's played out in Ukraine has not been something that Russia has, as it were, got away with in terms of what the international response has looked like. And I think that's introduced this real additional question in a way that we can go and look at what's gone on with the Russian economy over the last year. And you know, one can debate and you have debated what the cost of the Russian economy have been. China's economy is, of course, vastly larger, vastly more internationally interconnected and not dependent on commodity exports in the same manner. So the same sanctions imposed on China would have a very different effect. China has much greater retaliatory power as well. And there are plenty of people who think that in a certain sense, it's virtually impossible to go ahead with the same kinds of sanctions on China as were put in place on Russia. But from the Chinese perspective, as you saw when they gathered all of their kind of banking officials to analyze the impact of what was done on Russia's central bank reserves and things, they have to take this into account. They have to take into account the wider kind of landscape in terms of what situation China would find itself in afterwards. And so there is a significant military dimension to this and the difficulties of conducting these operations. That was, you know, even truer in the case of an amphibious invasion of Taiwan as it was a land invasion of Ukraine. But if there's anything new that's been taken into account, I think the prior question that was asked about the military implications, I think, is something that China is still processing on this. And I think, you know, again, we'll have additional reasons to be cautious, more cautious as a result of what they've seen than bolder, certainly as a result of it. But then this wider kind of landscape of, you know, what is China, what does the world look like afterwards? I think they'll be more cautious from the perspective of the situation that they may find themselves in as a result of taking action like this than they were before, because I think they would have been relatively confident that the sorts of measures that we've seen are not something they would really have to take into account, swift cutoffs and all of these things.
Well, maybe as one final question, I want to return, you know, to the question we're asking here in, you know, the headline of this episode. You know, is China really ready to arm Russia? And I mean, you've touched on this on a lot of different angles already, but maybe to bring it back home, I mean, what in your mind are the things, if this is going to happen, if Xi and the top brass, they decide, okay, we're going to say, do this, it's going to go through some cutouts. What are some ways that we are going to see that this has happened? And what are some things that you think that maybe might be the indicators that something like this has gotten the thumbs up from Beijing?
I mean, as we're seeing, a lot of the intelligence on this is coming from the Russian side, as we kind of discussed before. I mean, there's a question of how effectively it's really been possible to penetrate some of the decision-making processes and things on the Chinese end. I would recommend the interview from with Dennis Wilder, the former NSC senior director for China and CIA analyst on China, in which he goes through and talks specifically about some of the questions relating to transfers of artillery and the difficulty that there's also been in being able to effectively identify whether these have taken place or not. Again, I mean, some of these things that are well-established networks in exchanges that have been going on in recent weeks with Chinese counterparts and things. I think you're already, people start to ask about things like semiconductors that are finding their way over to the Russian side and spare parts and all of these sorts of things. There's already this kind of, well, you know, this isn't state sanctioned. This isn't being directed from the central government. There's a whole plethora of companies doing these sorts of things. I think you would start to see, you would start to see it coming from some of these specific companies. You will start to get kind of peculiar numbers showing up potentially with some of the third country transfers. But particularly, it would seem, if it's artillery, I think this is going to be harder to determine with as much clarity. I mean, when there's the question of, you know, whether semiconductors are kind of being sourced from the Chinese side, these are being analyzed on the battlefield. I mean, people are disassembling weapons and finding precisely what the sourcing is for some of these semiconductors. Whereas I think in the case of artillery, that will be much trickier. So I think we'll get a version of this if it happens. And I think they're aware that green lighting this is something that would be likely to show up, that everyone's watching this right now, and there are going to be real risks involved. But if it came to, you know, an uptick of supplies to certain other partners who then provide some of their own supplies to Russia, these sorts of things, I mean, it's perfectly imaginable that we could see this sort of thing happening in the coming period of time to kind of test out what the reactions will be if they do go ahead with doing some of this in the slightly more deniable ways.
Okay, well, it sounds like this is something that everybody's going to have their eyes concentrated on and be watching very, very closely in the days and weeks to come. Unfortunately, we're going to have to call it there. I want to thank Andrew again for taking the time for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and thanks for answering all the questions from the audience as well. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Talking China and Eurasia on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you like to listen. Also, please sign up for the China and Eurasia newsletter, which comes out every other Wednesday. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, I'm Reed Standish, and thank you to Andrew Small.
Thanks very much.